Looking for a fun way to win 25 times your money this football and basketball season? Test your skills on Prize Picks, the most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. Just select two or more players, pick more or less on their projection for a wide variety of stats, and place your entry. It's as easy as that. If you have the skills, you can turn $10 into $250 with just a few taps. Easy gameplay, quick withdrawals, and injury insurance on your picks are what make Prize Picks the number one daily fantasy sports app. Ready to test your skills? Join the Prize Picks community of more than 7 million players who have already signed up. Right now, Prize Picks will match your first deposit up to $100. Just visit prizepicks.com/play100 and use code play100. That's code play100 at prizepicks.com/play100 for a first deposit match up to $100. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber. This episode of Red Inca, we talk about equal pay for women's cricket and what that really means with an expert on the topic.
Raph Nicholson, Senior Lecturer in Sports Journalism at Bournemouth University and freelance cricket journalist.
We talk about how match fees make up very little of a player's income, the history of professionalism in men's and women's cricket, Asian cricketers working in jobs so that they can still play the game, the ECB contracting women, WBBL, and whether the women's game could be separated from the men if Taylor Swift were to buy it. Okay, how many boards in the moment have equal match fees for women and men as we sit here and talk, Raph?
I think it's four. So in the last year or so, it was New Zealand first, then India, then most recently South Africa, and a few days ago, England.
So it's a trend, and it probably is the sort of thing that looks very good on a press release, plays very good on social media, annoys the right kind of people on social media as well. How many people, though, do you think who see this sort of casually flick up in their feed realize that that doesn't mean that the women get paid the same as the men? Actually, you might know this more than I do, but, you know, in men's cricket, the actual match fees probably make up less than 15 to 20% of what a man actually makes playing for his nation in most countries.
Yeah, it's a tiny proportion of the overall earnings. I would say a lot of people don't realise, and I think that there are lots of people in the media who don't seem to realise either, and actually kind of muddy the waters a bit. So I pulled out some of the coverage of the ECB's decision to introduce equal match fees for the women. There was a tweet by BBC TMS which said, men and women will now earn the same when they play cricket for England. There was a Crickinfo headline that said, England women get match fees hike to be equal with England men. No. And then there was some other various headlines saying England men and women cricketers to receive equal pay. So the press cover it in a way that gives the impression that it's equal pay when it isn't.
And I do think that it's a tough for a headline writer. It's probably a tough, not for the tweet. For the tweet, you should have enough room. For a headline writer, it maybe is a little bit tough to fit it in exactly the way that you want it to be. But the truth is that, you know, traditionally in cricket, your match fee was your, you know, 80 to 90% of what you made. And then as Cricket Australia come in with contracts and they understand that these players need to be, you know, you can't just pay people to play games because obviously injuries become a thing and you want your players to be available and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So as that comes in the 90s, where cricket sort of follows, you know, rugby league and Aussie rules in Australia, we start to get contracts. That feeds into, I think, all of the world now. You have your centralized pool of players. You know, you have 20, 25, 30, 35 players, depending on the country, depending on the situation. They are then paid a salary regardless of if they play any games, right? And then when they play those games, they then get an individual match fee. So the players who are actually out there doing the job, you know, get that. And, you know, I think it used to be $1,000 per game for a West Indian player to play a test match. I would hope that's gone up slightly, but that I think that was when I talked to Chris Gayle in 2012. you know, I think it was a third. I have to go back, but there's a lot of countries that don't pay a lot for match fees. So that's not where, as a cricketer, you're making the bulk of your money. The bulk of your money is in the actual contract itself. And that just seemed to be either ignored or, and I'll put it to you this way. This is a feel-good story. And you might feel like, and you and I don't feel like these sorts of people, but other people might feel like a bit of a dick for going, well, England have actually trying to do something right here. And then for the rest of us, you know, people like you and me to go, yeah, but that's not where you make the majority of your money. So that's kind of a pointless thing. I think there would be some people out there, especially that don't know about this, who would feel more comfortable just going with the headline and going with the good news rather than going, sorry to shit in your cereal, everyone. But we need to actually discuss this a little bit more.
Yeah, but I do think the cynic in me actually thinks that the cricket boards encourage this perception, and because they know it's a feel-good story and it's an easy win for them to look like they're doing something good on the cheap, basically. I mean, look at the situation that the ECB are currently facing. They've got this report by the Independent Commission for Equity that says, the current situation is not fair. Sexism and racism is rife across your sport, and you need to introduce equal pay, and that means equal salaries in international cricket by 2030. And what are you going to do? And the ECB look at this list of recommendations and they go, right, well, that one's easy. We'll issue an apology. What else can we do that's easy? Oh, they said that we need to equalise match fees, so we'll do that as well. But the really difficult call and the really difficult one financially is the actual overall equal salaries. So I suppose what my cynicism about this is partly because I think that the cricket boards, the ECB and others, do this as a way of generating good publicity when it's easy for them to do.
No, I agree. I think that's 100% what they did, and they realized that the vast majority of people who would be repeating this wouldn't understand what you and I know, and wouldn't look into it that much either, right? It's a headline. You put it up on your site if you're a cricket aggregator, and you let it go. And we saw New Zealand do that. It's why I didn't cover it when New Zealand did it. I got a lot of questions at the time. People were very excited, and I was like, because if I do, I mean, I have to go into the fact that it's not as good as you think it is, and it's not what people believe it to be. And it's worth stating that in the 2012 World Cup, and I believe this was the last World Cup that I'm aware of that this was the case, but in the 2012 World Cup, the T20 World Cup, or what was it, the World T20, as it was called at that stage, that was a dual men's and women's tournament, and the women got a lower per diem than the men. Because we all know that women don't eat as much as men. They don't want to do their laundry as much as men. They don't need taxi rides as much as men. All those sorts of normal things. And that was in 2012 to show you how bad things were. But giving women the same amount of per diem, again, doesn't make a big difference. And of course, that was seen as a win at the time. But there are so many obvious little things that could be fixed. The match fees is obviously one. But you did an article in The Guardian. You actually wrote it today, but who knows how long it will take me to get this episode up for people to actually see this. But you wrote an article in The Guardian today that said that the umpires for the women's 100 get paid. Is it a third of what the men get paid, or roughly around a third to, of what the men get paid? I mean, you shouldn't need hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on a report to work out that there's an error there. They're making decisions in that game. And, you know, that this whole story must really hurt those people who say things like, oh, well, you know, women's game doesn't make any money and the men's game makes more money. So, men's players should get paid more money. The umpires, how is that not a universal fee if you're doing a top level game, you know? Pay that test umpires more, pay that first class umpires less. You know, it should be on a sliding scale till you get down to development level cricket. I've got no problem with that. But how is umpiring in the women's game different to umpiring in the men's from a financial point of view? That doesn't make any sense. And also, if you're trying to get women into the game, is that not a cheap way of doing it? Like, for me, that would be like, what are you talking about? We've got, you know, all these women umpires over here and they get paid the same as the men. It's such a baffling decision. And it isn't really a decision, is it? It's that years ago, someone just decided it didn't matter as a game, so they weren't going to pay as much for it, and no one ever looked at it again.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And basically what's happened is that the women's game in England is becoming more professional. but the umpiring structure has not caught up with that. So all of the full-time paid employee umpires of the ECB are largely umpiring in men's cricket. And so then a lot of the umpiring in women's cricket is by people who are kind of on part-time retainers. And the ECB haven't quite caught up with these changes. The suggestion, as you say, that umpiring, particularly in the 100 competition, whereby they bang on about it being all about gender equality, and actually that's a really poor signal of how the measure by which you regard the women's games. It really suggests that, I mean, they're doing the same job. They're all on TV. They all have DRS. It's exactly the same. And yet the women, the umpires in the women's competition are paid less.
And I think, was it in your article you talked about, was one of the jobs was £80 a day for umpiring?
Yeah, so that's...
And I saw in the comments, yeah, what was that one? So what competition was that?
That is the that's the fee you get if you umpire in a 50-over Rachel Hayhoe Flint match, which is the women's professional 50-over domestic competition.
So that's got to be very close to minimum wage, as someone else was pointing out. And then, of course, you have to probably travel that game. You're probably not going to be a local, umpiring in that way. I mean, it's such a weird way of looking at it. And to go back to the 100, the 100 was marketed as this equal tournament. And yet the bottom pay for the women in the 100 compared to the bottom pay for a man playing in the 100 is, you're not... If you're a woman in the 100 and you're the 14th best player in the squad, you are not a professional cricketer. You are a cricketer getting a couple of weeks work. You make as much for going on a cruise and serving drinks, right? Like, it's not. Maybe you get more. I don't know how much you get paid for going on those cruises. You couldn't pay me enough to do that job. There's so many obvious ways that the 100 made a mistake, but. Because it's umpiring, and also because, let's be honest, and I say this all the time, people still complain about the top level men's umpiring. And I was like, you need to go and watch a first class game. And the other thing I say is you need to go and watch a women's game. If you want to see crap umpiring, it's not happening on the international panel. There are some umpires who are better on the top of the international panel, and it's a tough gig, and we go over every individual decision. I mean, there was a run out in the Women's World Cup in 2017 that was... the mistake was made, and it was about a 40 centimeter mistake, right? Like, and they didn't have DRS, of course, because they didn't need it for that particular tournament for some reason. And like, that's just a mistake that just probably wouldn't happen at the top level of cricket. Even now, they don't give the decisions anymore. Some of the umpiring that you see at women's cricket, and it's not just women's cricket because it is first class cricket. It's some of the lower T20 leagues. And, I've seen some very good A-level umpires at times where I was like, oh my God, does this person actually know the full laws that they are supposedly proceeding over here? But there's no doubt that there is women's cricket umpiring is something that is a long way behind where it should be.
I think that's right, but I don't know if you've come across Anna Harris, who's one of the kind of up and coming young umpires in women's cricket in England. Apparently, either last season or the season before, one of her first seasons umpiring in professional women's cricket, they do analysis of the umpires' performances across the whole season. Yeah. And she was top of the of all umpiring in England. Mm. But she's on one of these part-time retainer contracts. It's also nothing to do with the gender of the umpire, but it's just that there are less opportunities for women umpires. And the other frustrating thing
I'm not saying that women umpires are bad. I'm saying that the umpiring quality in women's cricket, whether it be men or women's, and of course it's bad. Because if you're a good young, especially if you're a good young male umpire, let's forget the women umpires for a moment, which is a whole separate issue. If you're a good young male umpire, why on earth would you not be trying to get to the men's game where you could actually do this professionally?
Yeah, well, that's what I was just going to say. And that's because the setup that we've got at the moment is somebody like Sue Redfern can only become a professional umpire if she says, okay, I'm going to umpire in lots of men's cricket. You can't be a professional umpire in women's cricket at the moment. A bit like you can't really be a full-time professional journalist in women's cricket at the moment because it doesn't pay well enough. But anyway, that's an aside. The money is all in the men's stream. And that's the structural inequality of English cricket. And I'm assuming it's equally the case in other countries around the world. So that's the frustrating thing. And the ECB say we want more women umpires. Oh, and also we're going to filter them into umpiring women's cricket because role models, all of that. Now, I get that. Okay, but what you're effectively saying then is that all of the women umpires are going to then, for all of their umpiring careers, be subject to worse pay and worse conditions.
Yeah. Well, and also, do you remember the last World Cup, they decided to have all-women panels? And again, it goes back to the equal pay PR. Oh, that's great press. But my first thing was, have we been training these women correctly on DRS? Are these women already, are they experienced umpires? Or are you going to have a worse quality of umpire because you haven't been pushing any umpires? And then suddenly, as a show that you're on side, you're going to promote them all. You're putting them in a position to fail. And if you're a part-time umpire, that means you actually have to do other things. Whereas Sue Redfern is in a position as a professional now where she can actually travel the world. And even when she is not contracted for English cricket, before she gets to the ICC panel, and the ICC panel is like, you know, that's when you've made it, right? That's a whole different level. But there's a level between that, right, where you can travel around the world, you can do franchise cricket, you can go and do, you know, major games overseas, and it means that you're a professional umpire. And chances are, even if you're not a particularly good umpire, you know, Rod Tucker, you might still get better at the skills that you need to be over a period of time, right? They're not in a position to be able to do that if you're a part-time umpire and you're not at that level where you're being recognized. So the whole system doesn't really make any sense. Let's forget about the umpires for a moment because no one wants to talk about them, Raf. let's go back to the professional women's cricket. Yeah. So I would assume, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I would assume that the first ever professional women's cricket league is what we call the Reds versus Blues. I think you've even been on this podcast talking about it before, but essentially some random French-American entrepreneur realized that if he put a bunch of women on a cricket ground together at the same time, he could bring people into the games. The sad thing is he was 100% right, but he didn't really go out and get the best cricketers. It wasn't like me. What's the movie in America, with the baseball movie with Gina Davis and everything?
Field of Dreams? Is that it?
No, that's the men's one. There's a woman's one. Everyone who likes sports movies will know the name of this movie, except for you and I at the moment. But it wasn't like that when they went out looking for the best women's baseballers to play in a major league. Yeah. They literally went out, and what they did was they looked for pretty young women. They then gave them false names, if I remember correctly, paid them. Except for the fact that eventually he ran off and didn't pay them for the second part of it, but started to pay them. They played as professionals. People came. From that, that was 1890?
1890.
Yeah. So from 1890 until England making their women professional in, what was that, 2012, 2014?
2014.
Yeah. Between that, Raf, could you tell me a brief history of professionalism in women's cricket and... If there was any.
Oh, goodness. I'm just trying to think. I don't think there was. And I know that there's going to be people screaming at that now going, oh, yes, there was.
I reckon there would have been games where there was match receipts. Right? I think that would have happened on occasion, don't you think? Like, I know there's that famous... Occasionally. Yeah, but I can't. There certainly wouldn't have been anything beyond that. But I'm sure there would have been occasions where women got together and played a game. You know, there's that famous women's team from rural Australia that was famous in Warrnambool that people would go. They probably got some of the match receipts, although it might have gone back into the club. I don't know. So there were stuff like that. So you must have one or two of those.
In England, the Women's Cricket Association, who formed in 1926, specifically banned professionalism, and they were really obsessed with amateurism. But there were kind of women's cricket leagues in the north of England in the 1930s that were separate to the Women's Cricket Association and were generally kind of set up and run by men who thought, oh, there's, you know, a quick buck to be made here. Some of the women within those games were given kind of payments. There would be a collection if somebody scored 100 or took a few wickets. There might be a collection at the ground, and then they would get some money from that. And, you know, I guess similar to men's league cricket, sometimes they would be given kind of time off work to go off and play, and that would still be paid. So they were sort of a little bit professional, but not in the kind of structured way in which we currently think about professionalism.
So WCA is obviously a very important board in the history of women's cricket. It ends up being the one that runs the first World Cup, not with their money, of course, but with someone else's money. But essentially, correct me if I'm wrong, women's cricket, especially in England, and I think it's a bit like this even outside of England into the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but especially in England, women's cricket was very much played by women of a higher class who had the social ability to say that they were going to play cricket and not be told to, you know, go back to the kitchen or, you know, go and get a job or whatever that may be. They could afford to travel because a lot of those tours were self-funded and all that sort of stuff. So I've never said this to you before, but would you say that women's cricket was more elitist than men's cricket in that period from up until almost the 90s, I suppose?
Yeah, I think so. One of the things that I say in my book, Ladies and Lords, plug for that, by the way.
Which you can buy in all online bookstores that still sell it.
One of the points I make is that actually when amateurism was abolished in English men's cricket in 1962, a lot of writers then went, oh, we miss amateurism. We really love amateurism. I know, we'll kind of transfer that those feelings and that value onto women's cricket. So they write lovely pieces about how wonderful amateurism is in women's cricket. And, you know, when England women win the World Cup at Lords at home in 1993, you know, there are some lovely pieces written by cricket writers saying, oh, these are a wonderful bunch of girls because, you know, they're all lovely and charming and amateur. And actually, it's really unhelpful because it kind of associates women's cricket in that sort of category of we don't really need to take it seriously. But yeah, I would say it is more elitist in the sense of there being less opportunities to break through into it if you don't have any income coming in.
And that, I think it's probably stronger in England because the amateur stuff, well, actually, New Zealand is another country that was very strong on the whole amateur thing. You know, they don't pay their men's cricketers at all, really, until the early 2000s in domestic cricket. So that was a very amateur cricket culture. But even in Australia, you know, you go back through the stories and there was no money to be made in it. And it was usually women who were either quite successful and had flexible jobs or, you know, came from, you know, a family where they didn't have to particularly work or, you know, they had a husband or, you know, whatever that may be. There was a lot of that even within Australian cricket. And that's not really, you know, even not really how the men's team were by the, you know, the 90s and early 2000s. So there's certainly that part of it. The other thing I find really interesting, and I don't know if anyone's ever written a book about this. I know there's been a couple of really good books about the Indian and the Pakistani women's cricket teams recently. Don't think there's one on Sri Lankan women off the top of my head. But I think there does need to be a study into what the, you know, the old-fashioned way of Asian cricket was to get a man who could play cricket a job in your company. And then, you know, we always talk about Rangana Harath, you know, being a bank clerk. And he was, but he's a bank clerk that for about 5 months of the year was not in the bank. Right. And that was completely acceptable. That was part of his job. That was why he was there, you know, and the bank didn't know if he was going to go on to be a great cricketer or an ordinary cricketer. You know, India Cements, you know, one of the most famous companies in cricket did a really similar thing. I think Dhoni and Rahul Dravid are both vice presidents of Indian Cements, had very lofty titles there at certain times. And it goes right across, you know, and Pakistan, the first class teams are obviously, again, and this happened in India as well, but they've just gone back in Pakistan to having railway teams and all these sorts of different things. That does flow over to the women. And, you know, Shikha Pandey is, between us, did we work out what her... Is she like a flight lieutenant or something?
Flight lieutenant in the RAF, yeah.
Yeah, and then a lot of the Sri Lankan women, I think the Sri Lankan women around, you might remember the year, but it was around 2010 or 2011, they got split up into three different parts of the armed forces. So some went to the Air Force, some went to the Navy, and some went to the soldiers' infantry or whatever you call that, the other one. I'm pretty much an expert on this sort of stuff. Right? But the point is that, that was that's actually a really important thing. Again, it's not quite full level professionalism, right? But it does mean that they were getting paid, they could train. There was an understanding from their bosses at times that, you know, that they would be putting a lot of their time into cricket. They would have to disappear for games. It's interesting that that doesn't get as, and I know maybe by that stage it was such an old fashioned way of doing things that it didn't get a thing. But that actually did help, I would have thought, you know, especially India and Sri Lankan cricket, to have some of those women have positions where they at least only had to work half the year and they could treat themselves as semi-professionals. It's not quite the same as being a professional athlete, but there's something in that, isn't there?
Yeah, definitely. So we've just seen, this is relevant, we've just seen the Sri Lankan women's team beat the England women's team at Chelmsford. The last time Sri Lanka beat England was the 2013 World Cup, 50 over World Cup in India. And that was just after the point at which they'd got these sort of semi-professional contracts from the armed forces. And it was seen to be a really important factor in how well they did in that tournament. And yeah, in India, the railways has always been a kind of force to be reckoned with in women's cricket. I think Mitali Raj was railways. I think that was one of the ways in which she developed her career. And it happened in England as well, actually. So for a few years before they introduced full professional contracts, Chance to Shine, the charity that works in state schools, had these coaching contracts. So
yes,
the ECB said, okay, they partnered up with Chance to Shine. And they said, okay, we've got these England women cricketers who can go into schools and do coaching sessions. So if you have contract them to do that, then they'll do that 50% of the time. And 50% of the time, they'll be training and playing cricket for England. And so that was the kind of compromise for a while. I think that lasted for about 5 years between kind of a little bit of professionalism coming in and then proper full professionalism coming in.
No, I remember that because I remember for a period of time, almost every time you contacted someone at Chance to Shine, like chances are it was like either a former women's player or a fringe women's player, because what it meant was that they started hiring other people from within the women's game as well. I think, you know, Rosalie Birch and you know, did Ebony do that as well?
Yeah,
I know
she
Ebony
did.
Was around.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there was, you know, some pretty decent players, you know, that were involved in that. And then, of course, so the women professionalism in England starts in 2014. The big boom really is the women's big bash and what they did professionally. How many women were, and I say professionalized because it's not quite professionalized as you actually, you had some women who were playing professional Australian rules football, professional cricket, and also holding a day job. So it wasn't like quite having a normal job, but how many women were actually being paid to play cricket in Australia? Was it something like 80? Am I remembering the numbers right? Or is it more than that?
Well, at the point at which the WBBL came along.
When they first started, that first initial rank, because I don't think everyone was fully paid,
no,
were they?
It's actually a really tough question, because you could probably turn around and say that not all domestic cricketers in Australia, even now, are professional, because some of them are holding down other jobs. So like Georgia Redmayne is going off and you know, working in the hospital as a doctor and that kind of thing. It's very.
You've just glamorized that a little bit, by the way. Can I say that the vast majority of women's cricketers in Australia are not going off and being doctors?
No.
It's. I know of two, and I've always said this. It's funny that there's two fairly famous cricketers who they work in auto parts companies, and you know that you go in and you try and buy your muffler. See, I know the lingo, Raf. And you know they go and get you the muffler and they sell it to you. So certainly that, but there is a. At the same time, there is a vast majority of women who are getting paid to play cricket in Australia that hasn't happened in other places. And it is given, we talk about that as the boom of Australian women's cricket. It's the thing that sort of gave them that big shot in the arm to become the, you know, the Harlem Globetrotters of cricket.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So I think that it trickles in slowly over a number of years rather than suddenly arriving with the launch of WBBL. And there's also a big kind of sort of head-to-head battle going on between the ECB and Cricket Australia, because the year before the ECB introduced its professional contracts, Cricket Australia introduced a massive pay rise. And arguably, that was kind of the same like levels of pay that the ECB then introduced. But the ECB said, well, our cricketers are professional, whereas Cricket Australia said, no, ours aren't quite professional and we're maybe a little bit more honest about it. The ECB were like, no, they are professional, even though if you were on the bottom tier contract, then you actually probably were still supplementing your income by doing something else. So like I say, it's very much blurred lines. I don't know if the same thing kind of happened in men's cricket in any period, but it's very blurry.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, if you go back to the history of men's professional cricket, you have those original tours that the men, so the original test tours that were made by England teams and by Australian teams are really, they make those tours to make money on for themselves. So they are professional cricketers, but it's more like an entrepreneurial thing. So when the Australian team get together, that's more the famous one of they all chip in some money so that they can get over on the boat and that someone organizes it and, you know, to pay the team manager and everything else. But then at the end of the tour, they split up all the money and go back. So, you know, it's not a professional structure in the way that we would see it now, but they found a way of making money of it. But then if you look at after that, what happens is that they are paid match fees. They're not given contracts. You don't know if the Australian team's going to pick you. And so you are largely amateur for the next 70 or 80 years, unless you go to England to play cricket. And then you might play in a league or and eventually in county cricket as a professional. English cricket has the county system, which I believe I'd have to go back through, but I don't think that was contract. That was you got paid to play. You played so many games a year. You obviously got paid to play in, you know, you didn't just get paid to play in like the main county games. So you would play in, you know, Yorkshire might play, I don't want to say a local bank, but Yorkshire might play a minor counties, or there might be another kind of game. So there was all sorts of other ways that you could make your money all the way through. But then in the off season, all those people usually had another job. And traditionally, if you weren't a major county player either, you probably had another job while you were a county player. Right. So, you know, that's the stories of the England bowlers, like literally walking out of the mines in the morning, going down, putting their bowling boots on, bowling, and then, you know, going back and doing an early shift in the mine the next morning. So men's cricket really doesn't become what I would say professional. We have little professional pockets in it that people are making money, Raf, but it's not particularly going to the players. Yeah. So, you know, MCC are certainly making a lot of money. They seem to still do okay. You know, Cricket Australia start to make money. Some of the other smaller boards start to make little bits of money as well. But that doesn't flow on into the players. So what that allows for is for the Rebel Tours, for Kerry Packer, for someone like Julian Khan, but even for the league cricketers. So the West Indians, you know, the famous Garfield Sobers story is that Garfield Sobers was going to play league cricket over the West Indies because he got paid more to play league cricket than he did in the West Indies. Mm-hmm. And even if you go back to Sid Barnes was in a position where he got paid more to play league cricket than he was playing county cricket. And so if you have a look, he doesn't play a lot of county cricket. So it's really scattered, and who gets the money is a little bit dodgy all the way through. In Asia, as I said, you have this thing where you eventually get paid to play for a company or for an organization. And then, so it's not like those guys were suddenly rich or anything in that way, but they had that little bit of money. County cricket, you have it, but you only have it in for one half of the year. So you're not paid all that much money and you're not truly a professional. Then the big boom comes in, I would say really the early 90s when the Australian men become contracted all year round. County cricket obviously follows that. Then most of the international teams in the world over the next 10 to 15 years follow that. The money starts to trickle down to first class cricket. So the New Zealand players went on strike, Raf, in first class cricket in New Zealand in 2001. But technically it's not a strike because they'd never been paid before. So they just stopped playing. so it tells you how late it was that you could be the 15th best player in New Zealand and not make any money for your first class cricket in New Zealand at that time. So it's not as if men's cricket had money, but because of the league system in England and because there were, you know, you could play club cricket in Melbourne and, you know, get some money, and club cricket in Sydney and get some money. If you were a good cricketer, there was a chance for you to make a little bit of money in random ways all around, all the way through. Whereas in women's cricket, it does feel like until the board sort of got involved, there wasn't really a way to make any money at all, even if you were one of the best women's cricketers in the world. The only way would have been very occasionally, there would have been little sponsorship deals, but I would have assumed you would have had to have been Zoe Goss or Rachel Hayhoe Flint to probably get any money off any kind of sponsorship. And even then, it wouldn't have been enough to make you feel like a professional. That would be fair, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And the Women's Cricket Association, again, were really against individual sponsorship deals. So I actually had this big falling out with Rachel Hayhoe Flint about that, who was trying to get more sponsorship and trying to actually introduce this idea of giving a bit of payment back to the players and divvying up pots of money that she brought in via sponsorship amongst the players.
And that's quite a big deal as well, yeah. Because she's a Tory peer. She's almost the face of what amateurism would look like. And even she's saying, we have to actually start to pay these players. There are certainly men who believe that as well, but there are lots of men who played the amateur game in English cricket were more than happy to, you know, for the working players not to get looked after. So it's quite a big deal for your most famous cricketer and a cricketer from that privilege and background to be trying to actually professionalise the game. But I can see why it would not have worked as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's a really interesting one politically when you think about where she ends up. As you say, being a Conservative peer in the House of Lords, this is actually quite a socialist system that she's trying to introduce into English women's cricket in the sort of late 1960s, early 1970s. And there isn't an awful lot of money knocking around, but her view seems to be that the money that there is should be distributed actually to the players rather than the WCA retaining it all in a pot to then kind of distribute as they see fit. So it's an interesting one. Yeah, her views are maybe a little bit internally inconsistent politically.
Yeah. Now, so we're at a stage now where, you know, the term equal pay is being talked about a lot in women's cricket. We both don't think that this is anywhere near equal pay. It is a PR statement as much as anything. But I think we both agree that it's a step in, again, in the right direction. And maybe by the year 2030, that feels a bit optimistic, Raf, but, you know, England cricket or maybe another cricket board will be the first one to make sure that the men and women are paid equally. That's going to happen bit by bit, right? That's not going to happen in one big thing. And, you know, the other, of course, huge talking point, which we can barely fit into this podcast, would be that by the time 2030 comes around, cricketers will probably be paid a lot more to play in franchise cricket than international cricket anyway. And so international women's cricket, I don't even know how strong it will be by 2030 because franchises might completely swallow it up. But let's assume that doesn't happen and women's cricket continues to grow. There are more test matches, or in some cases, some test matches being played, and women's cricket is thriving by 2030. It's probably not going to be that in the year 2030 that 50% of the money will go to men and 50% of the money will go to women, and that will take a while to get to anyway. Let's say tomorrow I gave you 25% of the total player pool salary to divvy out to women's cricket, right? In order for it to be equal pay, Raf, that would mean that let's say, I don't know what Ben Stokes is on, but let's say he's on £3 million a year. Would you then give Heather Knight £3 million a year if I gave you 25% of the total pot? Or would you be in a much better situation to make sure that the top 20 players are completely comfortable and have very good lives and will be looked after, you know, even as their bodies fall apart into their older age? But you actually spread that money out far thinner at the bottom end, make sure that there are, I don't know, let's say $5 million worth of contracts going out to women at £40,000 or £45,000 per person right across the game so that you get hundreds of people as professional cricketers. Is that not a better use of money as it trickles into women's cricket in the short term than making sure that the top women are paid the same as the top men?
It probably is. I think there are arguments on both sides. I think some of this is around like the symbolism and the messages that we're sending out. Because currently the message that we're sending out to everybody is that Ben Stokes is worth, what Ben Stokes does is more important than what Heather Knight does. And yep. I really dislike that message. And I think it's really important we try to combat that. And that's where your equal pay comes in, because you think, well, we need to actually send out a message that what they're doing is of equal value. But the way I see it, we should be paying Ben Stokes less and paying Heather Knight a bit more. So they sort of meet in the middle somewhere. And then, yeah, I do think that, and to be fair, Heather Knight would probably agree, because she's been, you know, somebody who has been vocal in and saying what we need to be doing is setting up a sustainable pathway for, you know, the England women cricketers of the future. And that involves putting more money into the women's professional regions. And it involves putting more money into women's club cricket as well. So you've got that system coming through. So yeah, probably the first thing that I'd do if you gave me that money is say, okay, we're going to make it so that each of the eight women's regions has a full cohort of domestic professional women cricketers. So I guess that would be 15 per team. So yeah. 15 times eight, you do the maths. I can't do maths.
Yeah, I'm not going to do the maths.
So that's what you would do with the money first. I don't think that we want to end up in a situation where the England women's team are earning stupid amounts of money, whilst people underneath them are struggling to pay the rent or to pay the electricity bill or whatever. So it would be better if we could follow a more sustainable model in women's cricket than the one that's being pursued in men's cricket. Unfortunately, women's cricket is run by the same people who run men's cricket. So it will probably end up, they'll make all of the same mistakes with the women's game that they have with the men's game. So I'm afraid we're back to separate governance again, which is a policy dear to my heart. Anyway, that's for another podcast, Jared.
No. Let's finish with that, because I think you know that I believe in separate governance for almost everything. So I don't think that the same people who run Test cricket, although technically no one runs Test cricket in the men's game, but I don't think the people who run the Test cricket should also be running T20 cricket, and the people who run ODI cricket should also be running Test cricket and T20 cricket. And it is the same with the women, right? You know, there's no doubt that the ICC played a part in women's cricket getting bigger over the last, you know, 8 to 10 years. But there's also no doubt that the ICC came in when women's cricket was already on the rise and was already a much more viable option because of all the work that women's cricket had done beforehand. If you separated women's cricket out completely from men's, right, if you had a WTA type situation, surely there is enough money now in the ICC events, right? And franchise events and everything else. So if you had a system where international cricket was run by a women's version of let's go back to the WCA, right? Just to use that name for a moment. So WCA run all women's cricket internationally. I know they weren't international board, but just go with me for a minute because it's easier for me to say it. If the WCA run all of women's cricket, they could also be the in charge of licensing all the individual tournaments. They could oversee the tournaments. They could provide the umpires. They could do what the ICC does for that. There would be a huge amount. I don't know how much the Women's Cricket World Cup is currently worth, but it's probably worth, you know, $200 to $250 million dollars over a 5-year period at the moment. You know, especially as you'd fit a few more, Women's Champions League, where, you know, Women's Leagues League, and all these different things that you could put into that. That actually would be a situation where the equal pay thing then it becomes completely separate, right? And you know, then it's up for the women to actually make the money themselves and to do that on their own and to look after themselves. The problem with the majority of all administrators in the world is they even as cricket becomes more diverse, the majority of the cricket administrators in the world are always going to come from a male cricket background, because that is where the money is and that is where the political power is, right? Women's cricket is never going to be, even if it's equal pay, it's never going to be actually run the way that it should be. It's very hard to argue that the ICC or the ECB or, you know, the BCCI or, you know, Cricket Sri Lanka or, you know, Cricket West Indies, any of these boards should actually be running this when the majority of the people who are in the positions of power are in there because of men's cricket anyway. Yeah. And I don't know. I don't know if women's golf is run on its own. Women's tennis is certainly one that is run on its own. They play to separate audiences, as we both know. It's not that there isn't a crossover. There's certainly a crossover, as there is in tennis, but they do play to separate audiences. If you have an organization at the moment that had the ability to make that much money off this tournament, right? And then spread that out and hopefully have other T20 tournaments and everything else. Would women's cricket in the next 10 years be in a better situation, or would there be a regression because you suddenly don't have the backing of, you know, all the different boards around the world and the money that they have already earned?
Well, I think it would be in a better situation because I think it's about autonomy and independence and being and having control over your own sport, basically, because I do think that women's cricket and men's cricket they're the same sport, but they're also very different. We've all been in crappy jobs that are well paid, but you feel you don't want to go to work because somebody else is controlling your life and you hate it. Wouldn't we all rather be doing something that we love? Obviously, like the money matters, but maybe a bit less money, but a bit more autonomy and a bit more ability to feel that we have control over our lives. And I think that example of our feelings that we might have had in individual situations is women's cricket, a microcosm of what is happening with women's cricket across the world. Is decisions are being made by a load of blokes who don't really care about women's cricket, certainly don't prioritise it. It's never at the top of their agenda. If we had separate governance, it would be the thing that the organisation would exist for, and that would be really crucial.
Yeah, I think what it'd be interesting. I'm going to give you another option, which is privatization. So you would have to buy the World Cup off the ICC, right? Or license it off them, or whatever system that we do, because you need that World Cup money, right, in order for this plan to work.
But why would we have to buy it off them? Did they buy it off the WCA? Because the WCA came up with Cricket World Cup. Did the ICC ever pay women's cricket any money for licensing the thing that
they wouldn't have
developed?
I don't think they would have paid them, but I think it would have been part of the package when they came across, would be that the ICC would own the rights to what. So you know about the Disability World Cup that was played in England in 2019, that they couldn't call it a Disability World Cup because if you use the phrase Cricket World Cup, the ICC owned that. And I think they would only be able to do that if they had those rights. The other argument is if you completely privatized it, you might just call it a World Series, or a world event, or you could come up with another name for it. But the point is, I think one way or another, you want some of the access to what the ICC has done over the last 10 years, the stuff they've done. But if it is completely privatized, and you had, I don't think you need that much money to actually buy all of women's cricket to get all the best players involved. And it would be a really good investment because whatever women's cricket is now, if we look at what it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago, if there was someone who actually came in and just bought it and said, well, I'm going to do what Fairbreak did times 10,000, right? And I'm going to completely professionalize the women's game. Every decision we make is going to be with the women, so there's that thing from that they talk about in Fairbreak of having shorter tournaments because women don't like being away for as long as the men do. All those sorts of things, starting to ask the women players what they want to do and how they want to structure their tournaments, all these sorts of things. If you do get to that point, privatization is actually a very decent option. And it wouldn't cost all that much. I'm not saying that you have the money, Raf, but it actually wouldn't cost all that much to be able to do that. There might be someone in the future who just works that out. Because at the moment, we know that it's so sporadic and spread out. And as you said, at best, it's the second thing on the agenda. And usually it's the fourth or fifth thing on any agenda, right? Whereas, an entrepreneur could come through and go, well, what's women's sport going to be like in 20 years' time? If I can break even in the first 10 or 15 years, in 20 years' time, I'm going to have owned the biggest thing. And the other way of doing it, of course, is to go back to what you were just saying, is with the star players, they can be offered bigger salaries through privatization, but you can also offer them, a percentage of the business and equity in it to build it correctly. I think that is the way of doing it. I don't think having another cricket board just for women is going to work. Okay. I think it has to be backed by a big chunk of money.
I feel a tiny bit nervous about that because what if we end up with like Elon Musk running women's cricket?
You definitely would. It is Elon Musk. He's already called me.
Ultimately, it's a man in charge then. Are there any like really rich women entrepreneurs who might want to come along and put some money in?
No, well, I mean, I think you need to be a low end billionaire, right?
Okay.
I don't know how many women low end billionaires that they are, but I think your major thing is really understanding how to get the streaming out there. That's where you're going to make your money back off this particular.
I've got an idea.
It will be a combination of that and advertising.
I've got an idea. We could get Taylor Swift to buy women's cricket. She's got money.
How hard's that? And she's certainly not someone who occasionally, makes decisions based on emotion, or that she might regret later on, unlike Elon Musk. But no, look, I do think that there is something to that. I just don't think I love your idea of having it as an independent organization. The problem with that is if it's an independent organization starting with no capital, does women's cricket actually regress at the start just because it takes a while to get back up? I do think that the way that cricket is going is towards private ownership. And you're right, of course. But there are, you know, the Ambani family is someone who could set this up in, you know, from the money that they have in the back of one of their sofas, they could set this up. There's a lot of very wealthy people around the world who could do this. And the one thing I would add to this, Raf, is that women's cricket has often been backed by very wealthy people. This isn't as it's not as an alien a thing as maybe it might sound to other people. We know the first Women's World Cup was done in that way. We have seen, you know, the Pakistan women's team at time, has certainly had wealthy benefactors. We've seen a lot of different women's cricket around the world have benefactors before. The difference is now that there is a chance of actually making that money back, right? You're not just putting it out. Like, I think it was in your article I read recently that when they had the Women's World Cup in 1973, they basically couldn't afford any cricket after that, right? They spent so much of their money at that point that so they had a World Cup and it got press, you know, there, and people talked about it and the trophy was there and everyone was really excited. And then they couldn't afford to have any cricket afterwards. And that's the difference between having a solid business plan and actually investing the money correctly and just having someone give you money for an event. And I think that, I think there's something in that. How you prize women's cricket away from the ICC at this stage would be a really, really interesting one. And of course, the other thing that you would have to work out is how to get women's cricket into the Olympics. I don't think women's cricket can survive without extra teams coming in. I think you need, you know, Brazil and Japan and USA and China and those sorts of teams to, you know, start to play to a decent level as well. Just because it's not going to have the depth of men's cricket when it starts. But all these things are possible, right?
Yeah. If anyone's interested in starting a revolution, then let's talk.
Email Raf directly. The thing is that I think I know you well enough, Raf, to be like, if a billionaire did contact you, you would instantly distrust everything about them and undermine your own genius by not being happy with what they do, which would be, I now wish that this happens to watch the mental anguish that you would have to go through to try and be on board with this, but at the same time be like, should we really be getting them to wear skirts again? Are we sure we want to go back to the skirts? Do we need a calendar? I don't think we need a calendar of the women's players. I think it is fascinating. But the whole thing with women's cricket and professionalism, when did you start writing about cricket? Around 2014, 15? Was it around
then? A little bit before then. I started my PhD in 2010 and I was starting blogging about 2012.
Even for all the negatives and us talk about that, I think if in 2010, if you were to have sent a text message back then, wouldn't it? It wouldn't have been WhatsApp. If you'd have sent yourself a text message at that stage, say into the future, saying in 2024, the women and the men will be paid the same amount to play a game of cricket for England, not the same salary overall. What do you think, you'd have to send it back from 24 to 2010, wouldn't you? You wouldn't be sending it in the future. But if you were talking to your 2010 self, I still think you would have to say that this is a massive, you would have thought at that time that would have been almost impossible and that it would have felt like a massive step forward, even if you would still have been you would have been younger then. You might have been slightly less cynical. I don't know. But it's still a it's still a huge step towards something that you've probably hoped for the majority of your life.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in the ECB only introduced the concept of match fees for the England women's cricket team in 2011. So we've travelled a long way. But obviously, I say this all the time, the balancing act between what I do with my life is to grateful or pleased for the progress that has been made, whilst also going, no, I'm sorry, we're not going quickly enough. Can we speed up, please?
Yeah. It's funny because you do that in the women's game. And I think that at a certain point, I do a similar thing in the men's game, which is, especially when it comes to the governance of the game. And occasionally something good will happen and people will be like, look, this thing has happened. And I'm like, yeah, but it could have happened 30 years ago. And it's happened, but it's probably more of a ceremonial thing and actually won't make a big difference. And I feel that, you know, you and I are sort of trapped in this thing of, it is better than when both of us started and things are moving in the right direction. And we can be happy that certain things, I mean, we have an umpire who's a woman who is respected enough to travel around the world, an umpire, right? Like, things have happened, but we still don't have, you know, a woman head coach of a men's team, right? Like, we still don't have the kind of, you know, basic structural things when you look at cricket boards in the world of having, you know, lots of women involved in the actual decision making and all those sorts of very basic things. But, you know, as a historian of the game who, you know, knows what used to happen, it's still a lot less shit than it used to be, but it's still a little shit.
And that's the new tagline for the England and Wales Cricket Board.
Thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Jared.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are many other extras as well, including a Discord channel. There's a link to those in the show notes. Please review, subscribe, and tell all your friends about our show. Word of mouth is the best way of making our podcast grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bharat Sundaresan and Bayram Kazi. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston. Each episode is produced by Ishit Kuberka at Sound Potion Studio. The team from 42 help us out with the video side. Orajoti Saina Payan and Maida Akam, both producing podcasts, while Mukunda Bandreddy is the head of our YouTube content.